Welcome to our program this evening. This is co-sponsored by the Gloucester Writers' Center and the Rocky Neck Art Colony. Now, what is environmental art? Do we count prehistoric cave drawings or maybe around Mount Rushmore? Do you remember that guy, Christo, who used to wrap islands in pink cloth? You know, in earlier days, environmental art might have been landscapes, but actually as a civilization, we had to get to a certain point before we could even appreciate landscapes because, you know, way, way back, before we had artists to interpret them for us, they were a mountain or a river was an obstacle, and trees were fuel or building materials. It all looks very different through the eyes of an artist, and it took a certain amount of civilization to appreciate the beauty in these things, and artists give expression to the deep love we feel for the natural world. Now, we have a whole new relationship with the environment now. We're consuming it and destroying it at a very scary pace. It's interesting that artists are making powerful statements about our relationships with land and water, and these messages are resonating in ways that, as panelist David Arnold has observed, science and journalism have been less than successful at doing. As always, we rely on artists and writers to interpret our world, and that's what these four people do through various media. Their work is thoughtful and compelling and beautiful and tragic. We're going to hear from all four panelists, Kyle Brown, Joanne Hart, David Arnold, and Karen Risteman, each of whom we've asked to make a 15-minute presentation, and after the presentation, we'll have a question and answer period. And I'm going to rule the clock with an iron hand. That's why my remarks are really short. We want to get right to what we're doing. So welcome to Creativity Rising from the Ecological Wreck. First, we'll hear from Kyle Brown. Now, Kyle is a Rocky Neck native. I know this because she used to trick-or-treat at my house on Halloween. She is an artist and educator and received her undergraduate degree at the Pratt Institute and her master's at Lesley University. She currently runs the out-of-school learning program at Peabody Essex Museum. Please welcome Kyle Brown.
Thank you, MJ. And just to update you, I'm no longer at the Peabody Essex Museum, and I run a program in Cambridge called the Cambridge Creativity Commons in affiliation with Lesley University. And MJ, thanks for opening with the thoughts about environmental art, because that's what I would like to talk about. Everyone can hear me okay like this? To kind of introduce tonight, to give a little overview and context about environmental art, a few artists that use it for various means and ways that MJ talked about, in particular, more activism, since we're here talking about climate change and that issue. So as you can see here, and as MJ was so validly pointing out, is that it's constantly changing. Our idea of the environment, our relationship to the environment, and the way that we interpret it. And so a lot of environmental art is site-specific, it's ephemeral, it's in collaboration with various other professions and communities to make a comment on a specific topic, on, you know, the way we feel about something. And I would say everyone that's presenting tonight may be an environmental artist in their own right. We might not identify in that way, but we have something that's tied to the environment. So I have to apologize. With the transfer of computers, text is off. So you'll just notice it in a few of my slides, unfortunately. But I know you'll bear with me. So just thinking about what practicing environmental artists do, just once again, you know, re-envisioning our relationship, informing, interpreting nature, looking at different forces of nature, reclaiming and remediating damaged environments. So thinking about artists as scientists, so this is one artist, Stacy Levi, and this is a work done by her called Pink Wedge. And You know, when I first looked at it, I'm like, hey, is this controversial because she's wrapping trees in tape? I don't know how good that is for the environment. Kind of commenting on Christo and Jean-Claude wrapping things. Like, what is that relationship here, and how are they helping the environment or hurting it? But I thought this was a good project to highlight because what she's doing is using surveyors' flagging tape to mark where the rising sea level will be, and I don't know exactly what time frame, but if the forests were flooded by the rising sea level, that's what she's documenting. So it does have this powerful connotation to it. So she is really doing her research and being a scientist, and she uses lots of other weather patterns and such to document the Earth and in her work. Another woman is Betty Beaumont, and she was really a pioneer in this movement, back in the 70s. And this project that I'm highlighting is called Ocean Landmark, where she's taking coal fly ash blocks, so it's basically coal waste, and using a barge to put it in the middle or in the New York Harbor, essentially in the Atlantic Ocean, and it's building a new habitat for fish. So it's regenerating a fishing site to actually feed people. And she calls that art. So this is, you know, where our interpretation comes in. Do you think that's art? I don't know. That's your call. There's also artists called habitat artists, where they create specifically for animals to help regenerate their living areas, to help their breeding. And so this artist, Lynn Hall, has done a lot of that. These raptor roosts she does in the Midwest or Southwest, I believe. One in England. She's gone all over the world to build these. She calls it trans-species art. And if you're interested in any of these artists and want to talk to me after to get their names, feel free to do so. And I will share with you. This should say artists as activists, and this is interesting to me just because I actually worked on this project out in Oregon, so I thought I would highlight it having that personal experience called Washed Ashore. And the idea is that we would collect plastic from the beaches and use that plastic to create these sculptures of animals that are affected by the marine debris. So the plastic pollution is identified as marine debris. And then we took these sculptures and brought them to different venues as educational tools to share about this growing problem. And one thing that she liked to highlight was that she doesn't just use specific things that she finds. She takes all of the trash that she finds, the plastic trash, obviously some ropes, sorts it, and uses every single piece. So she's not just using the certain pieces that she wants to. So transitioning a little bit to some of the work that I've done that I thought I might highlight, especially this because it was in Gloucester, is a project I did that was, you know, commenting on the decline of the fishing industry and thinking about looking within the... Oh, it might be on a timer. Sorry, guys. Thinking about working within the community to fill a need. So I used fish... now it's not going forward. Come on. Do you know why it wouldn't be moving? Oh, what did I do? Okay. Did you press up?
Nope, down.
Down? Okay. All right. Oh, sorry. I think this might be from another slideshow that has timings on it. So I chose three different fish, the bluefin tuna, the codfish, and the swordfish, and I looked at their, you know, conservation status as a way, you know, of commenting on them. And so, I try to work within the community as much as I can. So I try, you know, I think of myself or want to think of myself as a community artist and try to do community engaged projects through art, you know, when I can. To talk about important issues. It's not doing it. I'm sorry.
Down arrow?
Oh, sorry. That was me. Okay. All right. So I partnered with the Gloucester Y. And all right. And here's the final collaboration on Crescent Beach. So the fish, actually, they were quite large, but it's really interesting when you look at it, you know, in that scale, you know, and you think about how gigantic our world is, and we are such small creatures on it, but we make such a huge impact. And so I think this was really interesting for me and fun for me to get families and people out there that may not have come to think about actually collecting and discovering things on the beach, getting outside. And thinking about, you know, what is this outline? What does these fish mean? It wasn't just, you know, the kids are the ones that are the most interested, but then they bring the adults. So it's really great that way. And then you can see the one on the far end, I believe, is a swordfish. We used all debris and marine debris that's, you know, washed up from our beautiful harbor. And so after that is completed, I was able to take it away and, you know, throw it away. So it essentially becomes a beach cleanup. And I think we'll have time because I think I'm going fast. And to show a little more detailed video of that just in a second. Okay, yay. In my most current work that I have been doing has been this project that I'm kind of dubbing Negative to Positive, but don't quote me on that. It's a project where I've been collecting marine debris. So I definitely, you know, I growing up in Gloucester, ocean as inspiration, you know, marine debris has definitely been an interest of me, to me, you know, in a sort of, you know, awe-stricken way that we are actually doing this to our world, and also because I care for the ocean, and not knowing what I can do on my own. And so I started collecting it, not really knowing what I was going to do with it, and I started noticing that some of this debris has these really beautiful patterns in it that we humans have created, or machines have created. And so I started saving it and playing around with it, and I really felt like I needed to go back to this rawness of using graphite, which is basically pencil, and kind of representing this sort of earth, the earth, you know, graphite comes from the earth. And so I started using these, the marine debris pieces, essentially as templates to then create these designs, a couple which you are seeing right here, next to the piece of marine debris that I use. And my initial thoughts around this were thinking about taking something that's negative and creating a positive. And so in this case, you know, it's just a positive image, but I feel like that could be a start to a larger conversation. And if you look at the images on their own, you would never know that it actually came from this marine debris. So I'm still working on this series. I'm still collecting. I've collected debris from all over the country, or on both coasts, I should say. And I'm hoping to kind of expand it and, I don't know, maybe even show some of it here next summer. So it'll be good. So thank you, and I would like to do the video now, if possible. And I look forward to hearing your questions after. We have time?
Are we on time?
Yeah. Are we good? Okay, awesome. So thank you, everyone. I'm going to end with this video and of a project of mine that I did at the PBD Essex Museum in action of this beach cleanup through art, and I look forward to talking to you afterwards, so thank you.
Well, my name is Kyle, and I am an artist, and some people say that I'm an environmental artist because I do sculptures and things with natural materials, or I involve natural materials in my work. Today, I am working with the PBD Essex Museum in relation to the Trash Menagerie to come to the beach on this wonderful, beautiful day to do beach art with the community. We're going to create a large sea turtle. The hope is that people will come and help me, in so many words, fill in the sea turtle using the beach as our canvas with seaweed, debris, found objects from the beach, and in the end we'll have a mixed media, ephemeral piece of art on the beach. I think it's a great idea. I think it's creative.
A great time. Kids are having a blast.
This is just another great activity that the PBS Museum is providing.
I think it's a great idea, and when the trash gets scooped up at the end, that's even better, and it goes away, and we're cleaning up the beach. It's beautiful Dead Horse Beach in Salem, Massachusetts. I think it's great.
And it's a lot of fun.
Kyle, that was terrific. Kyle's bit about the plastic and found objects recalls. I don't know how many of you remember, but about 20 years ago on Rocky Neck, before the paint factory was owned by its current owner and it was still owned by Ruhl, there was a local arts group called Charva, and they collected a lot of plastic, colorful plastic bottles your timing. and made all these sea creatures underneath the paint factory building. You could only see it at low tide. You could climb down at low tide. Does anybody remember that?
Yeah,
it was great. and then, of course, they put the gate up, and we couldn't go see it, and Charba had to take it down. All right, next we have Joanne Hart, whose essays, articles, and short fiction have appeared in a wide variety of literary journals and national publications, and she's a regular contributor to the Boston Globe magazine. Joanne studied writing at Bennington College, and she lives on a farm on Eastern Point with a lot of really cute animals. She's the author of two novels, Addled and the recently released Float. Please welcome Joanne Hart.
Thank you, MJ. Did you say your name before? This is Mary John Boylan, by the way. Thank you, Mary John, for moderating for us tonight. And thank you, everybody, for coming on this very warm evening. It's getting cooler, is all I can say. The sun's going away. This is Float. Float came out in February. Float is considered environmental literature. This is eco-fiction, as in ecological fiction, and it's sort of a subgenre. And so I've talked a lot about this subject in the past few months. I've written a lot about it. Float is actually published by a press in Oregon. That is an environmental literature press that does nothing but fiction and nonfiction on environmental issues. So there's a lot of many books out there, of course, on nonfiction books and scientific books and books on nature about that things are coming to the end of the world soon. How really grim it is out there between the acidification of the oceans and climate warming, everything. That the words are probably the least easy, the least best way we learn. To read words on a page, to see these 27 letters just rearranged in different combinations, to have to use our frontal lobe to understand something, it's hard work. It's not easy. It's why we all fell asleep in school. So it's why the arts, actually, that movements tend to happen first in the arts, because we get it through arts. We get it through images and in the emotion. The good art bypasses the frontal lobe and will go to the limbic system. And once it does that, then we're moved to find out more. And then to go to words to find out, to help us figure out why we feel the way we do. And then to move to action, to try to fix the carbon in the air and the acidification, to move to action. I did not Oh, and fiction falls somewhere in between. Fiction are words that create images. So it doesn't bypass the frontal lobe as quickly as art does, but pure art does, but it gets there a little quicker than a dry recitation of facts on a page. You know, because for us to, like, do something about a subject, we've got to feel it inside. And it takes a lot of work, as I said, to feel something through an intellectual process. So I did not set out to write environmental fiction. I was simply setting out to do my art, to write a novel. And I had an idea of what I would do. I had this character in my head who owned a dehide plant, at which it dehydrates fish waste, for those who don't remember the old dehide in East Gloucester. And so I just had this character, and he was Duncan. Get it, Duncan? he had this factory. He was losing it. He had made it environmentally sound. The EPA had been after him, and you know, it was, and he had somebody work for him, Annuncia, who was after him to spend all this money to make it an environmentally sound factory. And then the fishing industry starts crashing because we've overfished the oceans. So he doesn't have as much fish waste as he used to. Neptune's Harvest is a dehyde plant, basically. Neptune's Harvest takes fish waste and makes it fertilizer, and that's what his business is. And so he... the book opens, so I have him, and his wife has left him. He's separated from his wife because he just can't pull himself together. He's living at home with his mother, and who's insane, and things are very grim for Duncan. So I just sort of had started with that, and then in the very first scene that I write, I have him, he sees lettering in the sand below his office. He sees the words, "God help us." These turn out to be conceptual art. He doesn't know that for a little bit, but the "God help us" is a reenactment of the 70s. It was a great time for conceptual art, and this is a reenactment of a 70s artist installation. And so he goes down there, and I'm thinking, da-da-da-da-da, okay, he goes down, and so what's at the beach? I'm just sort of, and I'm like, oh, my God, well, plastic's at the beach. So then all of a sudden there's the seagull, and the seagull has a six-pack holder wrapped around its neck, and he has to rescue it, and that sets the plot off. But the six-pack holder is plastic. They float in the ocean, and they look like jellyfish. And they choke a great many sea turtles and birds. It's six-pack holders. Don't use them. And if you have to use them, cut them before you discard them. So that's sort of so that's how I began. I'm just going to read you that one little paragraph here of Duncan. Duncan was lost in troubled thought when a ship's horn sounded, frightening the seagulls into the air with hysterical shrieks and a slow flapping of wings. All but one. There was always one. The large black-backed gull had a loop of a six-pack holder stuck in its beak and around its neck so that the sharp plastic dug into the sides of its face. The rest of the holder was bunched up around its head, and two of the loops formed glasses through which the bird stared at him with red, burning eyes. One wing hung limply by its side, dragging in the sand. The poor bastard could hardly move without making things worse, and Duncan knew that feeling all too well. The kindest thing to do was to let nature take its course. But when the bird opened its beak in mute appeal, Duncan realized he was screwed. He'd have to give it a fighting chance or never face his friend Yosefa Gould again. Yosefa ran seagull rescue out of her backyard, a cramped space where the birds went to linger in pain before dying. He looked up at the factory. He couldn't see anyone at the windows because of the harsh reflection of the sun. But even though he couldn't see his employees, he could feel their eyes upon him, and in his mind he heard them laughing. Let them. Wounded animals had to stick together. So that's where I began. And in fact, the first two chapters, early on, well before the book was completed, even I had a first draft, the first two chapters formed a story which won an important environmental fiction award. So, the plastic and the place really created, the first chapter created the whole movement for the book, which I was lucky because I didn't have to keep writing new first chapters until I got one to work. And so then during the process of writing this about plastic, so I had grabbed that plastic thing early on, and in the process of research, and this, I just love doing research, but any writer usually does, because it means you don't have to write. It means that you can, you got to get up, you got to go to the dictionary, you got to research on the internet, you got to just read a book, maybe many books. And in that process, I found out so much about plastic and marine debris. It wasn't just this unsightly thing on the beach. It was, and it wasn't just the six-pack holders. It was a toxic substance. It was a toxic substance that was creating, not just killing the sea mammals and the sea creatures, but it's killing us. That in fact it was the plastic as it degrades in the ocean exudes all these pseudo estrogens, and it's changing everybody's fertility. I mean, and then that became a plot point in the book, that the fertility itself becomes Duncan and his wife can't get pregnant, and everybody needs fertility assistance because of all these pseudoestrogens that are exuding from plastic. So the book goes on, working its plot, blah, 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 blah. And then I work in something else, and the whole fishing industry comes into play in the book, of course, because he works with fish waste. And I'm just going to end with this little reading here about Duncan and how the book changes on, let me see where we are. I can't see anything without my glasses. All right, so. That Duncan needs something to save his factory. And so I combine the two things, the plastic and the fishing industry, and that there's no fish, but what there is, instead of fish, because nature abhors a vacuum, is jellyfish. That jellyfish is choking the oceans, and that we need to find a way to use these jellyfish, because there's pretty much, it's going to be like at the end of the world, it's just going to be cockroaches on land and jellyfish in the sea. And so that we combine the whole plastic and jellyfish right here at the end. So. The dog whined in response, and Duncan saw that his front paw was tangled in fishing line. As he stopped to free him of it, he took in the sheer amount of garbage that had washed up lately. Detergent bottles, lobster boys, beach chairs, the tide of garbage rose and rose and never seemed to ebb. Annuncia told tales about a flotilla of plastic trash the size of Texas rolling around in the South Pacific. And seeing how much there was on just this small patch of land, he could well believe it. A million seabirds, he'd heard her scold a boat captain recently. 100,000 marine animals and sea turtles dead by ingesting our plastic every year. If I hear again that you've lost a deckload of fish bins and you don't go back to get them, you're going to join them. Another satisfied Seacrest client. There you go, old boy, he said, and he held up the filament for the dog to smell. Duncan remembered how he and Nod used to string line they'd scavenge off the beach with fish vertebrae they'd collect at the high tide line and make presents of them for their mother. She wore them still. Duncan, dear, his mother called, stop talking to the dog and come help us. She can't get the boat started, she and his brother. And it's out of gas, and Duncan suggests that this jellyfish soup that his friend Slocum has made that's in an olive oil can. Let's fire up Slocum's soup du jour. It's pretty volatile stuff, you never know. Nod and his mother agreed. One of the few things he appreciated about his family was that they never questioned even the most absurd comments or actions. If Duncan believed that soup could combust, well then, go to it. He popped the cap of the tin can and peeked in, sloshing it around to see how many solids were in it. But it didn't slosh. It was a solid. Or not, said Duncan. Nah, do you have your splicing knife? I guess I'll drive out tomorrow and get that gas can, said Nod, and he gave him the instrument from his belt. Their mother stood up straight and wrung out the tip of her braid, which had dragged in the water. Coming back up with us, Duncan? Duncan stuck the blade in the perforated can and started slicing the metal from hole to hole, and as he did, it crumbled in his hands. The soup must have begun to burn through the can before it solidified. I think I'll stay here a bit and watch the sun go down. He hit the hunk of solidified jellyfish against a rock a few times as if there was some answer to his life to be found inside. But it did not break. It did not even chip. He battered it around a bit as the tide continued to recede, leaving behind the garbage of modern civilization. Almost all of it was plastic, which would never change, never go away, only keep building up and up until they were trapped alive, living and dying in an indestructible world of their own making. He held the amber block in his two hands and wondered. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. All right, next. Photojournalist David Arnold photographs glaciers and coral reefs, following the work of Brad Washburn, who photographed the same sites in much of the mid-20th century. A graduate of Andover and Harvard College, he was staff reporter for the Boston Globe for 25 years. His work has appeared in some of the most prestigious publications in the U.S. Please welcome David Arnold.
Well, good evening. I cannot believe I'm going to have to really be intimate with this microphone. Can you all hear me? Because I can't talk any louder than that. So my mission when I started thinking about climate change was to come up with a system where I didn't have to use any hyperbole. What is happening now? And I speak to kids, I love talking to high school kids. And I find more effective than anything else is to just show the reality. So what I'm going to do for the next 15 minutes is illustrate how graphics and reporting and photography send a message that I'm happy with. Not happy, but that I feel is effective. So let's start with how this all started, and I'm gonna give you the cliff notes. I'm not going to explain the science. I'm assuming that I'm preaching to the choir here, and a lot of you know some of the science. But to kids, I think it's really important that they understand. I didn't start this as a missionary. I started this because I happened to be over in Switzerland doing an adventure story. I used to be a writer for the Globe. And I had grown up with this photograph of Brad Washburn's at the Museum of Science. All of you were too young to remember that, but this used to be up in the Museum of Science. Brad Washburn was the director and the guy who really put the museum on the map. And I revisited this site in Switzerland, and that's what it looks like today. This is about 60 years of change, and side by side, this is what the scene looks like. I took that to some glaciologists at UNH. They said this is incredible at 11,000 feet. So with kids, I then describe what fossil fuels do, what is the greenhouse effect, and I show a chart that illustrates what Al Gore used as climate change predictions and what the reality is today. This happens to be the polar ice cap. Another piece of graphics that I use is this incredible sequence done this spring in northern Alaska, the distance from Banks Island to the end of Alaska is from Boston to Chicago. This is an infrared photograph. And you watch what used to be multi-year ice, 6, 8, 10 feet thick, that would never melt in the summertime. And now you watch it on this incredible time lapse break all the way across those 2,000 miles in the space of about 3 weeks. That usually gets kids looking. So I decided to go back and reshoot some Brad Washburn photographs. This is the Goyo Glacier up in Alaska, and this is what it looks like today. And side by side, the scale is huge. For those of you who haven't been to Alaska, the state of Connecticut would fit in this. This is 5 miles across. It's totally missing. This is not ice. This is just ground fog. This is the Matterhorn, obviously. You've seen this before. That is after a major snowstorm, and I almost re-photographed this one to the same minute. I'm very proud of this. And this is what it looks like today after a major snowstorm, the same date, August 28th, and the same hour. And I'm particularly, I will be so brash as to point out the shadow line here. That's how you know I was within a couple of minutes of the picture. The Shoup Glacier near Valdez. This is in 1938 by Brad Washburn, and this is what it looks like today. I should have mentioned that the Shoup in this picture goes 5 miles in when Brad took the picture. This is the last glacier. I'm sorry. These were photographs that are still on a tour, actually. These photographs are now down at Duke University in North Carolina, awaiting the opening of a new space. But I use these glaciers as a volley to explain simply what is happening now. This is the Nunatak in 1938, and this is what it looks like today. And side by side, the cool thing about this photograph people have to point this stuff out to me. When Brad took this picture in 1940, this glacier actually continued to advance this way, and you can tell because of the terminal moraine here. And then sometime after that advance, it went into this tremendous retreat, and there's really nothing left of the glacier. I also show the kids a very effective summary of what's happened to the planet temperatures. It's a time lapse, but it's real temperature measurements. Has anybody seen this on the web? Oh, it's really one. Really, just one? No. No, and I'm going to spare you because I don't want to burn up the time here. It's a 28-second time lapse, and it shows you in real temperature measurements what has happened. And I will just, it's too hard to rig up and get the whole thing done. This happens to be what the Earth looks now like now with the planet changes, with the temperature changes. Let's not worry about that for now. And the science of this that's so intriguing is, why is the top of this photograph, why has it warmed up so much up there? Which is a great opportunity to talk about science. So, coral reefs. I had been lucky enough as a kid to photograph, not to photograph, but to visit Jamaica, and I was just spellbound by the colors down there. And I had heard that coral reefs were in trouble, and so I set about trying to find photographs of reefs that I could find again. It ain't easy, because nobody who takes pictures back then, and they were all taking the pictures, the only pictures I could use are transparencies, because I have to blow them up for what I hope is going to be an exhibit. So I had to find transparencies, and I had to find something I can find again. I had to find something with a topographical feature in it to prove to you that I'm looking at the same thing. So watch, I'm going to run through a bunch of these now, and I'll just tease you. Watch this formation here. This is in St. Croix. This is the Buck Island Coral Preserve. And this was in 1995, not very long ago. And this is what it looks like today. And this is very typical of what you see down there. This is off of Key West, 1970. This is what the scene looks like today. And this is in Discovery Bay in Jamaica. And the grid was used, 1978 this picture was taken. The grid was used by scientists who, this was a marine lab down there. And so they would put this grid out every, whenever these guys were doing the measurements. And watch this pin right here, which anchored the grid. And that's what it looks like today. A couple of more before and after pictures. The top is 1970, and my picture is 2 years ago, two springs ago. The remarkable thing, I haven't been giving you all the details, but the guy who took the first picture is right here. He's now 85. He's still diving. This is the largest brain coral in the United States. It's off of Key Largo. Did I hear somebody say Key Largo? Wow, it's right next to the Christ statue. Big submerged statue down there. And typically, I won't tell you. But what's happened is that with corals like this, when they die, you end up with what basically just becomes a substrate. And a lot of soft corals grow off of it. But this puppy's dead. This is off of Key Biscayne. This is down another area of Key Largo, 1980, and what it looks like today. And I have GPS coordinates for all of these things. The significance of this picture is that this is what is probably the largest brain coral in the world. Nobody knows of one that's larger than this. It's 18 feet across. It's probably 1,000 years old. And it is in a very remote part of Tobago. Again, I'm going to skip the science, but you've got local and planetary pressures, and in this particular one, you don't have hurricanes. It's off the hurricane loop. So it sits out there by itself. And this is what it looked like this picture was taken in 1982. And this is what it looks like today. And my last coral picture is of just some spectacular elkhorn down in Jamaica. And this is the same site today. Acidification, overfishing, runoff, heat shocks. I'm preaching to the choir here. So lastly, kids, what can you do about it? I talk about myself, and I talk about my incredibly bad habits, such as the boat I inherited that burns 7.5 gallons an hour at low cruise, skiing at Jackson Hole, where ski cats burn and deposit some 20,000 pounds of carbon a night, just so I can go ski on groomed hills. Remember, the average earthling deposits 2,800 pounds of carbon. This is 20,000 pounds, and I can go in all these boats. This is just horrendous. And this guy puts out right next to where I live. So, people, kids, this is a bunch of people lined up with ration coupons in World War II. They got it. It was worth the investment of time. It was worth sacrificing effort. Why aren't we doing that today? Open opportunity for people to talk. And in this particular room, obviously, climate change is probably sixth on our list of anything we're going to do tomorrow. How do you move it up to number one? And lastly, just so I don't depress the hell out of everybody, I point out this wonderful photograph taken by my new friend, a guy named Walter Bratton. And I would love to hear you tell me where that is. He took this about 5 months ago. Where do you think this is? Walter runs a fishing boat, an urban fishing boat. Guesses. It's not right. Very good. Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. And this is what it looked like back in the 50s and the 60s, when the Cuyahoga would break out almost monthly in these incredible fires that would just burn on the top of the river. The river was declared dead. Lake Erie was declared dead. And now Walter Bratton is taking tourists fishing in the same spot. So that is the cliff notes of what I do and how I try to use art to teach climate change. Thank you very much.
Stunning images. Excuse me, I'm not quite pulled together here. All right. Our last panelist. I first heard of Karen Ristabin some years ago when my daughter told me how much she liked her new art teacher. This art teacher also happens to be an attorney, an accomplished singer, a practicing artist, and the driving force behind the creation of the Rocky Neck Cultural Center. She's currently the president of the Rocky Neck Art Colony and makes her home here, right here on the neck. Please welcome Karen Ristabin.
Thank you, MJ, and thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm so thrilled to be doing this in collaboration with the Writers' Center, and I'm so thrilled that you're all out here on such a hot, miserable night, and because you care. I'm assuming that we're all here because we care about the same thing, so thank you for being in this collaboration of an event. So let's see what I've got. I don't see. I have to do one little adjustment to my system. This will take 2 seconds. Arrangement, no. All right.
And in the meantime, I forgot to tell you that Karen is the artwork.
All right. So the ocean, it's the largest ecosystem on Earth. It supports us. It maintains our world in a habitable condition. And among marine scientists today, there's a huge problem because I think generally they all agree that they don't do the best job communicating the issues of the ocean to the rest of us because they're not trained in communication. They're trained in the science. And I first started becoming aware of this conundrum talking to Ian Kerr of Ocean Alliance about maybe 4 years ago and asked him, you know, as an artist, what can I do? And basically he said, anything, do anything, because we can't do it. So that sort of led me on this journey that I've been on for the last few years. So I'm going to tell you about two pieces of work that I've done over the last few years. The first one deals with the issue of marine plastic pollution, plastic toxins, and the concerns shared by many in many different professions, and the impact of marine microplastics on the food chain, ultimately, potentially, our own health. In the second project, it was a collaboration called the Synergy Project, where I dealt with the effects of ocean acidification on shell-bearing marine organisms. So the first one, I worked on board this 72-foot sailboat Sea Dragon 2 summers ago in July 2011 with the Algalita Marine Research Foundation. We sailed from Hawaii to Vancouver, crossing the North Pacific Gyre, which is one of 5 worldwide accumulation zones of the plastic and other trash that the human race ends up putting into the ocean by various means. This group of scientists have traveled through all of the worldwide gyres, all five of them, to gather samples of micro and macroplastic fish and seawater, and they serve many different research institutions by collecting samples. So for me, that experience working on board this boat and a huge amount of research and endless editing contributed to a performance lecture that I've performed over the last few, 3 years in many places, marine science conferences and schools. And I consider that the art piece. That is the art. You know, people do ask, where's the art in all of this? I consider the whole thing, the research, the experience, the communication, and bringing it forward in a visual way as the art piece. It's a different kind of art form, which for me is a great fit because I was a practicing lawyer. I did trial work, so you know that plus the visual and performing art that I do. I can use the tools of advocacy from a law practice, but any of us can use our tools of advocacy if there's something we care enough about, together with visual language. And I tried to present the issue of marine plastics through the lenses of science and economics and politics and capital consumerism, environmental health, and public health, all in a 45-minute multimedia presentation. I know many of you have seen this presentation that I've done. Anyway, this is a little context. I used to make objects out of glass and other materials. I used to make objects to sell out of my studio. I loved glass. I was completely obsessed with its reflectivity and transparency existing at the same time and how it could potentially live with other materials. Water has the same qualities of being reflective and transparent at the same time. So I started making images of water, of the ocean. This is the one that's on Joanne's book, of light reflections and refractions. I was interested in the science behind light and how it comes through materials like glass and creates reflections and refractions. But I found myself wanting more from my own art practice. It didn't seem to be enough for me to make beautiful objects that represented what nature just does so well on her own. I did an MFA program a couple years ago, and one of my very wise mentors said, if indeed we are interested in nature, we need to seriously consider what that means today. We can't have a 19th century German romantic view of nature. The illusion is that we have access to unspoiled, unpolluted ocean. But our relationship with nature is so tenuous. When we romanticize nature, we reinscribe the illusion that everything is fine, that nature is a contemplative space, a nurturing space. But we can't undermine the urgency of the moment, he said, so be careful. Art is a representation of our human response to the world. Ask what it needs from you. Ask what's at risk, what's at stake, what is urgent. So as I began to notice more, I began to care more, and from the ocean I felt an overwhelming sense of awe and agency, and I decided to stop representing the ocean in my art in a literal way, and I began to ask how best to represent the ocean research to increase an understanding of the value of that research to society. And I thought about the vast range of means and media that we have as artists, what we see, what we think, what we try to understand. We can use facts, poetry, visual means, oral means. As artists, we're interested in what gets our attention, what has that initial take-your-breath-away impact, so that the content, the message, goes deeper. There are many ways for artists to link with marine science, and you've heard of some of them, and other disciplines for that matter, not just marine science. But in representing the problem of marine debris, some artists choose to represent the issue through cataloging their finds or for creating sculpture from trash. But I felt it's not a beautiful problem. While transforming trash into art objects can absolutely raise awareness of the problem, it doesn't necessarily get to the causes or the solutions. So I began my project by doing a 90-day beach cleanup. I picked up everything for 90 days and washed it and sorted it and photographed it. And this is from Watson's Cove. This is every day for 90 days. There was an immense amount of trash. It's just amazing. And so I picked it up, washed it, sorted it, and okay, I displayed it in a gallery. I, you know, put it in all these different categories and cataloged it and quantified it. But somehow it wasn't enough for me to say, well, humans, it's pretty ugly, right? And shame on us. And I started thinking, you know, there's got to be more to it than that. So I developed this performance lecture project to develop, for me, more substantive content about our plastics problem and to leave some room for personal reflection. In that project, I imagine that we're 30 years out, looking back to 2013 and asking ourselves what we did back then to respond to this problem of our plastics. I based the story around my own lifespan from the 1950s through now, because my lifespan is about the same as the lifespan of our plastics addiction. There was no plastic pollution on the beaches or in the ocean when I was a kid, because the vast amount of plastic came from the throwaway society, as dubbed by Life magazine, and was just beginning to accumulate. That's when we got handy wrap and plastic grocery bags and thousands of other one-time, single-use plastic products that we're guilty of using even tonight with our plastic cups. They could be around forever because they won't biodegrade. And plastic throwaways end up in the ocean, which is downhill from everything on Earth. On board Sea Dragon, we trawled the surface of the ocean, hundreds of miles away from anything, and we found plastic. This was our trawl system. We found plastic everywhere, mostly microplastic bits that look just like plankton to the sea creatures that eat plankton. And I learned how plastic toxins are implicated in some of the biggest public health concerns of our times, and I began to think, what can I do as an artist with that visual language and different kinds of communication channels? With sound and image, how could I do something about this enormous problem? I looked at the evidence from physicians, marine scientists, epidemiologists, environmental scientists, and I looked at the alternatives to the way we viewed our own habits, our own plastic waste stream, and the responsibilities of the producers of the products we use. And I asked, what did we do 30 years ago in 2013? How did we as humans respond? And I get into all of these alternatives and alternative ways of thinking about our problem. As artists, we want to produce a form of consciousness, an intensity of feeling, an energy for action. If you think about a piece of artwork you've encountered and how it made you feel without even thinking about it, this thing called affect, it's a physical sensation we get from the things we encounter, whether it's a sound, an image, a snippet of conversation. Affective media can engender change more than factual evidence alone. Creating art, you can create opportunities for people to experience something that is important to you and important to your world. Proust said that the weight of a truth experienced by our sensing being is a much more profound weight than one arrived at by reason or deduction alone. So the questions I ask at the end of the performance, what did we do with our knowledge, don't need immediate answers. They call for introspection and engagement with the seemingly intractable issues affecting our ocean, because we've caused those issues and they're demanding our attention. The second project, which I've done in this vein, was the Synergy Project, as I said, conceived by an MIT graduate student in marine science who happens to love art. Eight artists were linked with eight MIT and Woods Hole marine scientists making collaborative work, which was exhibited at the Museum of Science in Boston from February to June of this year. I worked with Sophie Chu, who is a graduate student, studying ocean acidification and its effect on pteropods. Ocean acidification is basically that a third of the excessive CO2 that we dump into the atmosphere is absorbed by the ocean. This causes a chemical reaction resulting in a lower pH, which means that the ocean is becoming more acidic and causing shellfish to corrode and causing them to be unable to grow their shells in the first place. So she studied, and I was learning from her, how the ocean's changing chemistry is affecting the ability of pteropods to survive. These are also called sea butterflies. They're the most beautiful organisms I've ever seen, and they fly with these pads, and they are just gorgeous, all different species of them. And this is what happens to them over a 45-day period being exposed to acidic ocean water. So I made a sculptural piece made out of 350 eggshells, which are made of calcium carbonate, which is the same as pteropod shells. I acidified the eggshells to show the effect of an acidic, corrosive sea on shellfish, and this is what they look like. There were 350 to correlate to the 350 parts per million we're striving to stay below in the atmospheric carbon we create, but we're at 440 parts per million and rising. I was honored to be able to give a talk at the Science Museum during the exhibit's run with the message that if you love our planet and you have a way of communicating about the things you love, the things that matter, there's a place in the world for you to do so. This is basically my artist statement: disentangling complex information, predisposed toward the sublime, and creating a research presentation whose beauty resides in the honesty of the moment when message and medium converge. This is my offering. Thank you.